Welcome to the Religious Studies Project, hosted by David Robertson and myself, Christopher Cotter. This project is produced in association with the British Association for the Study of Religions, and you can visit our website at www.religiousstudiesproject.com. Animism refers to belief systems which attribute a soul of some kind to non-human beings such as animals, trees, rivers, or natural phenomena. To discuss it, we're joined today by Dr. Graham Harvey, reader in religious studies at the Open University, and the author of Animism, Respecting the Living World, published in 2005. Dr. Harvey, welcome.
Thank you.
I defined animism as a belief in which non-human entities possess souls, but is it as simple as that?
Well, there are people who do interpret the word and use the word animism in that way. However, what I think is the more interesting, more recent discussion of animism goes in a quite different direction and requires us to think more carefully about the words we use. So the attribution of souls, entities. Obviously I'm already starting to speak my different language, which is the word person. Mm-hmm. So let's tackle the attribution of souls. Certainly for Edward Tyler in 70-something, in his monumental book, Primitive Cultures, he certainly defined animism as belief in souls and spirits, mm-hmm. By which he did mean something like metaphysical entities, non-empirical realities. So the attribution of something human-like where it's not really warranted in other than human beings. So certainly it was a belief system, but what he was doing was defining the whole of religion, so he didn't mean just indigenous people or people elsewhere. Mm. He also meant good High Anglicans, Presbyterians and others also had some belief in souls. And you can find evidence of that. People do use those kinds of words in different religions. But what interests me much more is a very different understanding of the world in which we have to speak about other than human persons, people perhaps is more simple. So the word person or people would be an umbrella term, and underneath that there would be humans, bears, rocks, different kinds of being or person who are in some senses personal beings. So in the one case, Edward Tyler's version of animism, the questions that would be asked are, how do you know that this is alive? What's the difference between a living thing and a dead thing, or a living person and a dead thing?
Yeah.
Right. Whereas in the animism that interests me more, the question is very different. The question is, how do I show respect to other persons, some of whom are not human? Right?
Yeah.
So there's already quite a big shift there. And so one of the classic occasions where these two animisms, two ways of thinking about animism, kind of come together is an anthropologist called Irving Halliwell, who in the 1940s and 50s spent time with the Ojibwe of Barron's River in southern central Canada. The Ojibwe or Anishinaabe live in the central Midwest of the United States and in southern central Canada still. In their language, they make a grammatical distinction between animate persons and inanimate objects, just as we do in some ways in English.
Mm-hmm.
But their distinction between their inclusion of various things like rocks are animate persons grammatically.
Mm-hmm.
So the word asin, in its rock rather than singular, in its plural form, asinig, is an indicator that it's a plural being, a person of some in some sense. So Halliwell asks an Ojibwe speaker, an old man, he never names him, he says, are all the rocks we see around us here alive? So the question is, how do we know whether it's alive or not? And the old man pauses, thinks about it, and he says, no, but some are. All right? Which is great. And then he begins to explain what he means. And so what I like to say now is that it's like asking a French speaker, how do you treat tables, given that tables are grammatically feminine in French?
Yeah.
Do you treat them in a feminine way? I don't know what that would mean,
yeah.
But how would you do it? And the French speaker would say, don't be crazy, that's just the language. It doesn't affect our actions towards tables or things that are masculine and feminine. So the Ojibwe don't distinguish between masculine and feminine gender in that same way. Obviously they know what a masculine and feminine being is, but they don't make a grammatical distinction in the same way that La Table is a feminine noun. But they do distinguish between animate and inanimate in the nouns and verbs. So asin, asinig. So it's a perfectly sensible question, but the answer is kind of enigmatic until the old man explains that. That really, well, he doesn't say this quite this way, he's just told stories about how he knows that some of these rocks are personal beings. And he tells stories about how some rocks appear during a ceremony where they didn't appear to be before. Suddenly there they are, kind of joining in. And one day there's a rock in a white settler's potato patch, and this the white settler goes to this guy and says, "What? How did this rock get here?" And the Ojibwe guy starts talking to the rock, and there are plenty of other kind of examples. Sorry, I may have ruined that story, but that's sort of right. There are a number of stories in which people act towards rocks and all kinds of other things in the world as if they were people, as if they could respond in some way, or as if they might themselves offer a gift. So, for example, you might offer tobacco or kinnikinnick, a blend of herbs, you would do this with an elder. So you go to your grandfather, and you would, if you wanted the grandfather to teach you something, you would offer them tobacco or kinnikinnick before you ever asked a question. So it's part of the normal greetings. So you might do this with all kinds of other persons of the other than humankind in the world. That's quite a different world. That language says something about. So for that language to make sense. Now, that doesn't mean that... So when the old man said, no, but some are, basically he isn't saying, well, most of them are dead, but there are a few alive ones. What he's really saying when you get through all the stories is, you've really asked the wrong question. I'm not going to ask the question, is that rock alive? My question is, am I relating properly with that rock? So most of these rocks, we make the general assumption that they are alive. That's not really very interesting, it's a general assumption. But there are moments where we actually engage in some sort of relationship. We give gifts, we listen to each other. Most of the time, you know, rocks are just rocks in a field. You get them out of the way, you trip over them, you get them in your shoe or something. They're not really very interesting. But sometimes some rocks, or some... I think it goes for other beings that we might have a much easier time thinking about as being persons like a bear or an eagle, right, who we might be willing to think of, we English speakers might be willing to think of or to speak about as having some kind of agency.
Mm-hmm.
So, but for them, again, it's not about is it alive or not, is it conscious or not even really, it's much more personal. And so it's not a grand theory that all rocks, all eagles, all bears, all humans are alive or dead. It's a general assumption that life is pervasive, relationality is pervasive, and the important questions are, how do you show respect properly at significant times? So at some times, some eagles act towards humans in more significant ways than other times, and humans at some times act significantly towards eagles in certain ways. And at that moment, you are persons.
Right.
To each other, you're actually in relationship. The rest of the time, you know, eagles don't care about us. We don't care about eagles. So the struggle to say these things is to think outside of a Western world where we've got kind of fairly neat. We're used to our kind of differentiation between life and death, humanity, and the rest of the world. This is a different world in which anything might be alive, might be willing to be in communication, in relationship with us, but the important questions are about immediate relationship.
Yeah, for Tyler and the anthropologists that followed him, they viewed animism as evidence of a sort of childlike world of view and, you know, yeah, a very primitive world view. It sounds like you're describing rather a world view which is no less complicated than ours, but is quite inaccessible to us, with yeah, given our particular ways yeah of thinking.
There are moments where we get near it. So like when we swear at our computers or our printers when they refuse to print the essay because there's a deadline coming up. You know, we've all had that experience. Lots of people have named their cars. Yeah. So there are moments where we get near it. And then the other example of this might be that we all generally have an assumption of human rights. So all humans have the right to various things, dignity, life, and so on and so on. Now, that's a grand theory that we kind of, it's an assumption we make. We demonstrate it in a number of ways. And one of the everyday ways which we demonstrate our respect for human rights is when we're walking down a busy road, we don't, unless we're really arrogant, very unpleasant people, very antisocial people, we don't just walk in a straight line and insist everybody gets out of our way. We show our assumption of human rights by weaving along the pavement. Sometimes we go straight ahead, other times the other person goes ahead and we step around them. And it's not a conscious thing, it's just that's what people do. And it demonstrates the way the world is. Well, animism's like that. This kind of new animism that we're talking about. So yes, for Tyler, it's a primitive, childlike error that was made by the very earliest humans. But what's very important about Tyler, you shouldn't misunderstand him as saying it's just them. It's just primitive people yeah who've not had the benefit of education yeah who make this mistake. Yes, it's evident among indigenous people, as we now say, and it's evident among children. But he says that that's what generates the thing that we call religion, mm-hmm, and it still does. That religion exists. Religion is a way of explaining the world. It's a kind of science, but science is better at being a science than religion is. And for Tyler, actually, what he was much more concerned with was saying that religion in his era, in the Victorian period, had given up being religion, a kind of science, and it had become a system of morality. And he says that's not the job of religion. Religion's job is to try and explain the cosmos. Mm. When you give up that and say scientists can do it better, but we're going to insist on people being moral and decent and all that, you lose all of that stuff. I mean, so he thought that religion was going to die out, but not really, just because it was a childlike error. But so that's kind of Tyler. But there is, as you said, a much more complex, and there are a number of different complex, different kinds of animism. There's not just one kind. Yeah. So I don't want to even say now that I've used the example of the Ojibwe and related language groups around them. There are other kinds of ways of being an animist. So not everybody would say rocks are animate, but the thing that I think they have in common, all kinds of animists, is this general assumption of the personhood, the personal nature of the world. That basically what we encounter is potentially personal relationships all around us, and then you begin to act in that way, and you train your children to act with that kind of assumption. So the most common word in conversation with lots of indigenous people is the word respect. So there are locally appropriate ways of showing respect, but there are particular kind of ways of thinking, okay, I must show respect, how do I do it? So in North America, I use the example of tobacco and kinnikinick offerings. In West Africa, perhaps more traditionally, you'd pour beer for people yeah that you honour, humans and other than humans. So, and in each local context, the culture finds a way and encourages a way in which respect can be demonstrated when you find yourself actually relating. So does that make sense?
Yes, I think so, yeah. For me, that model of animism really problematizes our sort of dualistic worldview that we tend to have between the spiritual and the material world. And it's quite interesting, as you say, the inaccessibility to us to see the world that way.
Well, yeah, as I say, then you begin to think about these odd contexts in which we begin to touch the edges of it, and then we have to think. And the English language and most European languages, perhaps all European languages, have evolved in tandem with all the other bits of our culture. So it's not easy to say these things. So we live in a world full of dualisms, not just between matter and spirit, but humans and the rest of the world, mind, body, and so on. And they're all problematic if you make a different assumption. So, and just to be really radical here, if you want one of the most mind-bending thought experiments, in the encounter between Amazonian peoples and the first European invaders.
visitors.
There are two very interesting moments in that. One was at a council in the Iberian Peninsula where the Jesuits were discussing whether Amazonian people were humans. And so what they were looking for is a test that those people had some sort of spirit soul that basically you could convert them and they would get to heaven. So then you need to find something which we might say is culture or spirit in religious language, that they could believe things and they could do these things. So, and the Jesuits were arguing against slave owning other people that yes, the Amazonian people did have souls; they were human beings because they could do these things. They did have beliefs. And so on. It's a long, complex discussion. Now, in Amazonia, meanwhile, the Amazonian people also wanted to know, are these people human? So, because they might look human, you know, the bodies like ours, but bodies are not stable. Mm-hmm. And because they make a very different assumption to almost anybody else on the planet, really. And so their test, I'll tell you the test first, and I'll tell you why they had to do it. The test for the Amazonians wasn't have they got spirit, soul, culture. It was, are their bodies like our bodies? So you test that by sticking somebody under the water, holding them there, and seeing if they transform into some other shape.
Okay.
Or do they eventually rot down like human bodies would? And therefore you prove that, yes, they are like us, Amazonian people, human body people, and they're not really disguised cannibalistic kind of beings or something else. So in the very interesting work of an anthropologist, Brazilian anthropologist called Eduardo Viveiros de Castro, he writes about how in the West now we talk about multiculturalism because we have an idea that there are lots of different cultures around the world that come into contact with each other, and occasionally we have interesting festivals and we have interesting meals together in which one culture and another culture or multiple cultures get together. So we recognise that. But over against multiple cultures and therefore the possibility of multiculturalism, we have a singular thing called nature, which is fixed. It's matter. It's physical. You can touch the table. You can touch the body. Matter. Okay, there are questions we asked about matter, how is it made and so on, but basically it's a fairly stable, inanimate
We all understand what it is. Right, so we
know that. Now, in the Amazon, what they know is that there is one thing called culture, which is done by everybody, and I mean everybody, but the bodies are different. So if we were Amazonian indigenous people, brought up in a traditional understand the traditional way, trying to avoid the word culture here because it wouldn't work there. Anyway, for those people, they would make the assumption that what I see as a jaguar or a peccary, a pig, what it sees itself as a human being. So when I see it, I see a pig eating raw meat. It sees itself eating cooked food. I see an animal living in some sort of nest or hole. It sees itself living in a house. I might see a pig with lots of little piglets. It sees itself as having kinship structures, parents, family, of the same kind that is locally appropriate to the human people there. Now, so the problem then is seeing past the apparent nature to the single culture that's behind it. So some people, not everybody, but some people see past the apparent singular nature, which is only apparent. So they have, in short, they have multinaturalism and singular culture, where we have multiculturalism and singular nature. Now, that's not an easy thing to... I mean, it's easy to say it once you've read it and you think, right, yeah, that's how it is. But to actually practice that is kind of, you know, an interesting experiment. Go out in the park or walk down the street and try and think, okay, maybe they're right. Maybe that's the way the world is. But as I say, most Amazonian people live in a fairly ordinary way to us, you know, ordinary in the sense of most of the time you spend your life with other humans, you're not that interested in the goings on of pigs. You eat pigs, but occasionally you have to worry because if somebody has died and has become a pig, then when they come back into the village, if they do, which is a rather odd thing for a pig just to wander into town, so when it happens you have to think, what is that? Is it so-and-so who died come back to feed the people, give a gift of her flesh? So you need somebody to see past a shape. So again, it's that kind of basic assumption that the world is like that, is broadly animate in the sense of being personal, and there are moments where you have to actually act on that by giving gifts, expecting to receive gifts, or avoiding certain behaviours that might offend those beings, who might then get angry and do strange things to us. So you need people to protect you from the dangers of that way of living. That's where shamans come in.
Yeah.
Trying to avoid the word ism there, because basically I think that there's a way of behaving which is appropriately now, I think, called animism. And within that way of being in the world, the way of living towards other beings, you need shamans who can see what this being is and can deal with the problem that you're eating other persons who are not necessarily human. That could be an offensive thing to do. It's not, you know, you don't want to get eaten, and your family don't want you to get eaten. Yeah. So
sometimes,
yes, you might suddenly wish. You know. So if you go and eat another person of the other than humankind, maybe it offends the rest of that person, animal person's family.
Yeah.
So you need to persuade them to give up their lives for you. Tell them why. Apologise for the offence caused, but you might also want to go to the family and say, look, I'm sorry, we had to do this in order to survive, we only took the one, we didn't kill everybody, let's not make this a vendetta that'll go on and on until we're all dead. So, you know, all kinds of rituals and practices that negotiate between different persons of, you know, different kinds, that's generated because that's the nature of the world. So there are all kinds of strange implications, but in some ways it may be very strange when you hear it first or you see it at first, but there are some very ordinary human practices that happen here. And for most of those people, most of the time, you don't see strange things happening. They don't live all the time worrying about whether they're offending stones or whether the eagles might bring some knowledge today, but there are moments where things happen. So I was once in the Con River Reserve of the Mi'kmaq people in Newfoundland. They were holding their first traditional powwow, which is a kind of cultural dance performance. And this one wasn't competitive, but it was their first time. So it's kind of part of broadly speaking, a cultural revival for them, part of a whole thing about trying to get some sort of, you know, being happy to be indigenous people again. A bit like the film Brand New Day, I recommend to everybody. Very funny Aboriginal Australian film. So in this context, there were various things that happened, mostly just for humans dancing together and so on, but occasional people making offerings. But and for some people, they'd never been aware of what was happening in the kind of, what we might call the kind of religious bits of the edges. But on the very last dance, around the drum group in the middle, on the last day, an eagle flew across the river and flew a perfect circle around the drum group in the centre of the dance group, the dancing people, which is most of them. And it flew back across the river. And people stopped, and everybody, whether they were locals or visitors like myself, kind of went, what is it? Eagle, or in their language, kitpu. And it was like, okay, there are eagles all around there. You see them all the time. They go for the fish in the like in their in the people's fish ponds and so on. They're not a rare bird there, but for that bird to come across at that moment, you know, not 5 minutes before or 5 minutes later, to just fly around in a circle, just at that moment, everybody thought, well, that means something, and I just was chatting to various people, and they were saying, well, you know, it meant different things, but it was a communication. So one of the things it meant, a lot of people talk about cultural revitalization movements and how a lot of indigenous people are claiming back their culture. Well, these people are saying, no, what's happening is that our culture never died. The humans stopped doing the ceremonies. We stopped doing these things. We forgot how to show respect to the rest of the larger-than-human world. But the eagles, the bears, the rocks, the clouds, they never forgot. And this was the eagle saying, welcome back into the community that lives in this place. You're welcome to join in again, trying to live respectfully alongside all these other people. And I heard that in different ways from lots of different people there. And it was a very powerful moment. It was... You know, you couldn't have engineered that. People may have said, you know, this is what's happening here. We're reclaiming an animistic culture. But that's what brought it home to them and to other people, that, you know, it's not just a human experiment. It's an experiment of all kinds of living beings. So that's...
That's a nice place to stop.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, Dr. Harvey, thank you again.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
That was David speaking with Graham Harvey of the Open University at the British Association for the Study of Religion's annual conference in September 2011, hosted by Durham University. Graham is also the president-elect of the British Association, who are the generous sponsors of our podcast, and he's been instrumental in offering support and helping bring this podcast to you, so we'd just like to offer our thanks to Graham. Next week, I'll be speaking with George Casidas of the University of Birmingham on the insider-outsider problem in the study of religion. This relates to a scholar's status within the religious community that's being studied. Are they an outside scholar coming in? Are they a member of the community that's being studied? What happens to that status during the study, etc.? You'll have to download and listen next week to find out more. As usual, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, and we'd appreciate it if you could rate us or offer a review there, because that will help us in the ratings and bring in more audience members. You can follow us on Twitter at ProjectRS or on Facebook at the Religious Studies Project. Or if you want to send an email, you can email us on editors@religiousstudiesproject.com. As usual, we will keep updating the website with features, resources, and commissioned responses to these podcasts. This one for this week comes from Liam Sutherland, our friend at the University of Edinburgh. And we would encourage you to join in the discussion, either through offering comments on the website or on Facebook or Twitter. But for now, thanks for listening.